This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
I'm Scott Kirzner, the Boston Globe's at-large technology columnist. I went to see Howard Anderson earlier in 2005, just after he decided to step out of the venture capital industry, in part because he felt there was too much money chasing too few good deals. Anderson's best known as the founder of the Yankee Group, an influential technology analyst firm, and later as one of the founders of Battery Ventures. We covered a lot of topics: the digital home, outsourcing, the importance of building a startup sales organization before marketing, why big companies can't invent, and how startups can take advantage of that. Also, just as a note, we bleeped out some of Howard's bluer language.
One of the things I wanted to start with maybe is you write this weekly column, or I think it's a weekly column, monthly column for Network World.
Mm.
In your predictions for 2005, you said no new big thing in 2005. But then right after that, you said the digital home is one of the few bright spots when you look out into the future.
How about number 16?
What was number 16?
Wow, that's prescient. I somehow skipped over that one when I was reading it on Friday. 16 is HP struggles more than most and calls are made for CEO Carly Fiorina's head. And this is published, what, early January of this
December.
Year?
December. I hadn't done the thing in December before I left for India. Digital home. Yeah, but that's...
But that doesn't count as a next big thing, according to this column.
It's been coming. I mean, it's been coming for years. I was talking about this in 1980 when I talked about, you know, you come home you'd step on the scale in the morning and it would say 215 fatty and it would lock the refrigerator and start the coffee and send a message to your health club and all that stuff. So it's finally coming, but I don't look at that as the real next big thing. It's just one of the trends that we see. I mean, I was out with Xander and those guys from Motorola a few weeks ago. And yeah, you know, they're seeing... you know, cell phones that, you know, you can watch movies on, and you know, that's all part of this stuff, and memory gets so damn cheap that you can do it kind of where you want. And every home, one way or the other, has essentially a controller that does all this stuff. I got a house in Vermont, and the damn stuff is so complicated that I have the installer on my speed dial.
He's number one on your speed dial,
right? Right. You know, you go away for 2 weeks, you forget how to operate this stuff. I mean, that's part of it. When you know, whether it's the cable box at the head end or you put in something yourself, and you're going to take the same content with you wherever you go. I mean, you're going to look.
People talk about almost having a repository of personal content. You know, that's kind of this blend of photos and MP3s and stuff that video. You record off TV, video.
Video. I mean, there's you can build a Swiss Army knife that's a cell phone that does everything. I mean, it's a MP3 player. It's a video camera. It takes pictures. It stores it. It opens your garage door. It operates as electronic money. Usually the Swiss Army knife products don't work. You'd like something that's good at one or two things. But I think digital home is a 10-year thing, not just big in 2000.
I mean, it's interesting when people talk about the iPod and how successful that is. When you look at other MP3 players, they've tried to be more of a Swiss Army knife. You know, they have a radio tuner built into them, and some of them also record better than the iPod. And, you know, maybe the iPod's going in that direction with their new photo slideshow feature. But, you know, the iPod really just started out being just a great device for music.
Yeah, and idiot-proof. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, although I do think that if you look at the number of iPods that are returned for problems, you know, I've had enormous problems with mine, and they put a new hard drive in. You know, I look at my wife's car, which I had to almost turn back under the Lemon Law, and you start to see it's got a GPS system in there, and it's got music and whatever. That doesn't work, and that's why Mercedes is having a few problems. But yeah, it's part of it. Now, theoretically, you're going to be able to get something like Sirius Radio and be able to move that along so you can take that with you one way into the house and then you can define, you know, if you think about concentric circles and what you're willing to pay for, I am interested in kind of my music, I'm interested in my family, I'm interested in the physical health of 59-year-old white, slate, balding white guys. Okay, I'm interested in, you know, you start to say what I'll pay for in terms of content and delivery is pretty high. I know right now if I'm listening to the radio and I start to hear 8 minutes of ads,
yeah,
I just turn it off,
yeah,
or I switch channel, which is kind of a TiVo kind of revolution.
But one of the things that really interests me when you talk to people from Sirius Satellite Radio, or I was talking with the CEO of Akimbo, you know, one of these new TiVo-like boxes, and everyone has a $9.99 subscription plan. And I kind of wonder what's the – when do you hit the breaking point with consumers where, you know, their cable bill is $250 a month, you know, including internet access, and then they're also paying for satellite radio, they're paying for cell phone. You know, they maybe have a subscription for their watch where they're getting weather broadcast to their watch. I mean, is there a breaking point with consumers?
I have a patent, as you know, on a watch that tells you tomorrow's weather.
Uh-huh.
I got this in 1984. It's on the wall.
Really?
Yeah. My daughter was applying to she was about fifth grade, and she said to me, "What can you do with your watch?" And I was wearing one of those calculator watches, which they hand out at nerd conventions or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I said, sine, cosine, as if I remember what that is. And she said, "Can you tell me tomorrow's weather?" So I have a patent on a watch that tells you tomorrow's weather.
Oh, but Microsoft is infringing your patents.
Well, I'm giving it to Bill Gates.
Uh-huh.
Yes, they are. But
why are you going to give it to him? That sounds very charitable.
Because when was the last time anybody gave Bill Gates anything?
Uh-huh. It's been a while.
I mean, it takes. Actually, the damn thing expires this year, so I'm not giving him an awful lot.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I filed that patent in 84, 85, and I was using the FM subchannel.
Uh-huh.
Because the internet hadn't been developed.
But yeah, but that's what Microsoft is using for their Spot devices, right?
Relatively simple to do. You say, okay, give me the right area code. You tell me the area code you're going tomorrow. Oh, you're going to Chicago? I hit 312, mm-hmm. and it tells me what the weather is with an icon for rain or snow or sun. And you say, yeah, I pay for that.
Can we go back to my question, though, about do you think, I mean, the average consumer complains a lot about advertising, and they don't like advertising in their media, but is there going to be this infinite willingness to pay $9.99 to
here's the number.
Everyone.
The American family will spend 6% of its income on recreation. So show me someone that's making $100,000, I'll show you someone that's paying $6,000 a year for movie tickets, for TiVo, for cable, for whatever. And above that, it starts to hurt.
Uh-huh.
It was interesting as I was in India, the average family goes to Bollywood movies twice a week, except now they're starting to watch the movies at home and buy a subscription set. So you're going to take the money out of four-wall theaters and you're going to put it on electronic media, but it's still the same 6%.
So you were in India recently. What do you think the story is with India beyond just, well, outsourcing is happening and there are smart programmers in Bangalore?
We're way beyond that. Couple issues that are of concern to the Indian companies. One, the costs are going up. A software project manager in 2000 was getting paid about $6,000 a year. Last year it was $30,000. So now they're saying, where do we outsource to? And they're looking to Russia. They're looking to China and saying, okay, we got to offload some of this here. The easy thing is to say China manufactures and India does software, except when you look at things like television sets, in 2 years the Chinese will be the largest manufacturers of television sets in the world. Well, the new television sets are going to have software in them. So the Chinese are starting to ask the question, if the added value is in software, why are we going to let that go? We don't want to just bend metal and, you know, manufacture bras and whatever else. Also, in India, the high-tech sector is only 3 million people out of a billion. So these guys are thinking that's 0.3%. These guys are saying, how do we get some of the manufacturing jobs, if at all? So I see in 2015 this kind of global economic warfare, India versus China.
Within the Indian software industry, I kind of am intrigued by this question of, do you see purely original, sort of standalone, non-outsourcing related software companies cropping up? I mean, could, you know, will at some point India have its own Microsoft or Oracle or
here's
pick
what
your company?
Is that you get into the business by doing maintenance and all that. Mm-hmm. And I was with the president of a couple of these companies out there, and they say, yeah, we want to develop our own software that we can sell. And the way you do this, and digital equipment used to do this all the time, is you find a key customer that has a need that is broader than just their company. Mm-hmm. So you make an industrial strength, and then you sell it to other people. But yeah, India wants a proprietary software business. Now,
did you see any evidence that that's starting to happen already?
Yeah, you know, I did. And as you push these guys harder, where you go on with it, you want, I was out with Symphony, which is actually a Tommy Lee investment. Where are you going? Well, we don't want to do the low-level stuff on the triangle. We want to do higher level. Higher level, we want our clients to pay for it, but we want to maintain ownership of part of it. It will be a difficult thing to pull off, but they're trying to build that business because they want to get paid also for their brains, not their bodies.
I want to talk a little bit about entrepreneurship because you've been teaching it at Sloan for a long time, investing in startup companies through Yankee Tech. One of the themes, it seems like, when you talk about technology startups, and maybe this applies to all startups, is that sales is always the weakest link. Does it apply to pretty much every young company? Is that sales is kind of the most underdeveloped department?
We see all these business plans, and they assume sales at a certain point. Assume sales are going to go from 2 to 4 to 8 million. Hey, fuck that. It's very hard to do that. The cost of building a sales organization and a marketing organization is equal to the R&D expense. So if it's costing you 40% of revenue for R&D, it's costing you 40% for sales. And it's hard to do.
But a lot of people just say, okay, once the product's done, sales means just hiring the best hotshot salesperson we can afford.
Yeah, except you need them before. Because then you have the same problem the Israelis have. What the Israelis do is they sit back there and they figure out this is what the market needs, but they are not interacting with the customer. Mm-hmm. And the customer says, oh, yeah, these three things are important. These things are not important mm-hmm. to me. Here is what I need.
And you just spent all your time building things that aren't important.
And then they get angry because people don't buy, you know, what they want. So this close connection between technology, sales, and product development is crucially important. And that's why you need a little hybrid vigor. You know, you say, well, why don't you just don't hire the sales guys until the product's done? You need the sales guys out early. You need the sales guys to get the reference accounts. When somebody comes in and says, you know, the Newton Library is buying my product, who cares?
Uh-huh.
So, Fidelity, Don Hiley wants that product. Don Hiley's tested that product. Okay. You know, that's a good reference account. Can I go down and see the product in operation? Has he taken it from the development center and put it into his operating environment? Has he standardized on the product? That's why you need the sales guys in early. You don't need marketing. Marketing is just an excuse to lose money. What you really do need is sales.
What else do you see when you, I mean, you look at a lot of technology startups. What are other things that you see that are just common mistakes, or at this point in your career, seem to you just kind of, this is a dumb, a dumb screw-up that pretty much every company makes?
Sometimes companies are expecting changes on government regulation that's going to open the market, like, you know, the Fed has demanded, or the banking commissioner says by the year 2006, everybody has that, and so, oh, I'll build it. And what happens is that the incumbents convince the government to either water down the restrictions or to delay them. Mm-hmm. And now I'm there, so what? That's one issue. I guess the second issue that screws up companies is that they develop products that are too sophisticated for the channel. okay, I mean, you know, some of the stuff, like, let's take open source, for example. It's not for everybody. I mean, if I've got a world-class team, Goldman Sachs, whatever, I can put in some of these systems. If I'm a smaller organization, I better not try it because I barely can keep up here. So that's a real problem. And now I'm going to put this through the VAR channel. These guys barely know how to put the plug into the wall. So you also have the pricing issue. You know, one of the metrics in terms of the sales guy is, what can a good salesman sell in a year once he's been trained? Million, million and a half, 2 million. If my product is too cheap, $5,000, I can't afford to make a sales call. That's the second issue. The third issue is that, in fact, Clay Christensen and I have this debate together. Every company comes in here tells me they've got a disruptive technology. Not everybody can be disruptive. And usually the first product isn't disruptive. The first product fixes one problem, and not always elegantly, but very cost effectively. The next product gets to be a little bit closer to disruptive, but everybody cannot be disruptive on day one.
Why does everyone want to be disruptive? Is it just kind of great marketing positioning, particularly for a venture capitalist? You know, I want to come in and pitch you, hey, look, I'm going to shake up this industry. And
Because when exceptional returns have been made, they have been made by bringing disruptive technologies like voice over IP, mm-hmm. highly disruptive technology.
Yeah.
Back I am to my attackers and defenders argument that I've been making for years, that the venture industry backs attackers. Attackers have new solutions. They're 10 times as fast or 1/10 the cost. But most attackers fail. It's kind of like sperm swimming upstream. For all but one of them, it's going to be a very bad day. The defenders go through a very predictable kind of behavior. First of all, denial. This new technology ain't going to work. It's too scary. It doesn't, it's not standard. Anger. How come we lost a couple of our customers? Grudging acceptance. Look, if some of our customers want it, we better offer it to them, but let's not make it too good, because what we really want to do is bait and switch. You think you want to go open source, voice over IP, routers, whatever. We got it, but let me convince you why you shouldn't do it. And then in the end, when the technology does catch, our best friend turns out to be the investment banker. And the banker goes in and says, you got a hole in your product line, Lucent. You got to go buy these guys. And then it's kind of like riparian rights. The money comes back, and then it goes back out again, and we invest in new companies.
Are you less interested these days in venture capital? I mean, do you feel like you've kind of done what you have to do in venture capital, or are there some industry dynamics that you don't like as much anymore?
I don't like the industry dynamics. I think if you look at the price of companies getting sold today, software companies are selling for 1 to 1.5 times sales. We can't make any money in that business. I mean, we put so much money into a company, we need 10x kind of return.
Was it different when you started Battery Ventures? I mean, in previous cycles?
84. If you picked the right sector, you made 20 times your money. If you picked the right company in the sector, you made 50 times your money. Here, if you pick the right sector, you're going to make 2, 3, 4 times your money. And the right company, maybe 6 or 7. And also, there's just too many damn companies out there.
Yeah, that's been a common thread in these interviews. What's the impact for entrepreneurs? I mean, should entrepreneurs not be thinking about starting up a software or telecom company today? Should they be thinking about, maybe I should go, work for Morgan Stanley or work for my dad's hardware store?
It's a good, the contrarian's usually right. So if it's a bad time, it's a good time to start a company. But you got to look at 5, 7 years and say, it may take me that long. When we could flip these companies in 18 months, that was a no-brainer. I mean, it was, good times screw up companies because it brings so much competition.
But now, I mean, we're kind of in bad times and there's so much competition in a lot of these areas.
I think the communication sector is going to, in 2000, when, you know, Charlie Stein would call me and I said, this sector ain't recovering until 2005. And he would say, oh, no, it can't be. I said, okay, we'll see. So it's been 5 years. And the sector is still in the sewer. So if I have a billing system for whatever, you know, it's hard business. The only part of the business making any inroads at all is wireless. And even then, it's starting to slow down. So I don't like that sector. I don't like enterprise software.
But you said you do like voice over IP.
Well, remember, I invested in 1997.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, yeah, I liked it a lot in 1997. Do I like it a lot in 2005? It's common. Would I invest in a new company in that space? No.
Because you think all the players are already kind of defined. You know, it's whoever, Avaya and Sonos and...
Yeah, the winners are out there. It's late to the game if I'm the 85th company in this. But Charlie Giancarlo was by a couple weeks ago, who does the M&A for Cisco. And, you know, he's been my buddy for 15 or 20 years. And, yeah, these guys are bottom fishing, buying good technology, paying next to nothing for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to start one more company in that area.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't really – now, there's a danger in letting your – skepticism turned into rampant cynicism. And, you know, I call this the Paul Furry complex, which is, I'm here at the top of the mountain, everyone else is going to tread, you know.
Paul Furry of Matrix Partners.
I mean, Paul is one of the best venture capitalists in the country. And he's done, you know, extremely well at Sonus, extremely well at Cascade and Sycamore. And he says, you know, it's going to be really hard. Well, yeah, that's fine, Paul, but suppose you were 25 and not 65. Things change. I tell this hilarious story about Desch and Dan Smith.
Mm-hmm. Founders of Cascade and Sycamore.
Cascade was a hot company in frame relay. They had a bad quarter. The board panics. They sell the company out to Ascent. They sold it for $3 billion. So it wasn't like that bad. Ascent swore up and down they had great technology inside. They had shit. The only thing they had when they bought the company was Cascade's technology. With Cascade's technology, they sold the company for $20 billion to Lucent. Dan and I are on this program at the Harvard Business School 5 years ago, 6 years ago, called What They Didn't Teach You at the Harvard Business School.
Uh-huh.
I said to Dan, who was 10 years behind me at HBS, do you remember the class you missed that said, don't leave $16 billion on the table? At which point he gave me the finger, right?
Uh-huh. He didn't literally give you the finger at this.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know. So now when they formed Sycamore, when Sycamore was worth $50 billion, they ran out and they raised $1 billion. Sycamore hits the wall like every other telecommunications supplier. All of a sudden, there is no market. They can't bribe Williams, which is what they used to do here. No one's buying anything. CapEx in the industry is 20% of what it was 2 years before. Still losing $10 million a year, and they go to Dan and Dash, and they say, it was losing $10 million a year. And they say, well, this is terrible, because in 100 years, we'll be out of business.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you start to think about things in that way. You know, if you're a hot company, why would you ever sell that much equity? Aren't you going to dilute yourself? On the other hand, having that kind of staying power lets you fight another day, lets you sell your company and whatever. The same argument I had with my boy George Colony 3 years ago. You know, we had breakfast or whatever, and he said, you know, I'm under great pressure to buy back my stock. I said, don't be an idiot. The only people that want you to buy back your stock are those people who want to sell their stock. If you got,
you mean take the company private? You're talking about,
no.
or just do a stock buyback?
No, stock buyback, mm-hmm. because the stock buyback would get the price up. And I said, you got $9 in cash for every share of stock. Go buy something. So he bought Giga.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know whether it's a good or a bad thing. I mean, it's kind of better, but that's kind of what you do. You know, you assume that if you have those kind of assets, you deploy them in a different way, or you buy something to get the kind of stroke you want. So my view is that enterprise software and communications, the two areas, I mean, in communications, everybody made money. If you didn't make money in communications in the 90s, you weren't trying.
You wrote an article last year in Technology Review. I think the headline was Why Big Companies Can't Invent. Is that something that's universally true for all big companies? And that's just kind of the atmosphere that startups need to exist
in? Thank God that's true. I was down at Schlumberger about 2 months ago with Clay Christensen. And, someone said, well, it's every company. And thank God it's every company.
Even companies that have this, we have a 500-person R&D lab, or, we have an incubator, or we have, they all have these formulas.
And then you say, well, how have you done? What percentage, IBM is spending $30,000 per employee in R&D. How much is IBM growing? They're not growing for a squat. And what does IBM do? Every so often they have to go out and go buy it. And it really pisses off management when they have to go buy it because they couldn't invent it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is a big company will say, is this a billion-dollar market? None of these markets look like billion-dollar markets when they start. I mean, I remember when mortgage, this guy started Cisco. It wasn't a $12 billion market. It was a small market. The damn stuff actually kind of worked. the way Cisco got started is there were two horny IT people at Stanford University. And they wanted to send sexograms to each other or email, and they couldn't do it because they were on incompatible systems. So they said, I can build the system so we can say, they actually got married for a while and divorced or whatever. I mean, but was this a great strategic thinking? No, it was just bright people with a problem. Now, here's IBM and Ellen Hancock, who's got a $5 billion division in communications, and she's selling front-end processors at $2 million a piece. Someone said, these little $100,000 devices could eventually do what your front-end processor does. No. Not only that, if she introduces the goddamn product, she ruins her profitability. So, of course, she doesn't do it. So what happens at the big company is they like new technology, but they like it to come in when they're ready for it. But what happens is technology comes a lot quicker sometimes.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, big companies aren't ready for new technology until they feel like, oh, geez, this product line has completely died. Now let's maybe think about what's the replacement product or what's the next generation.
Yeah, I like to have just-in-time technology, and it doesn't work that way. And even the customers in the beginning are not the mainstream IT people. They're out in the peripheral.
Yeah.
I was down at...
sometimes they're people who are too cheap to buy your products in the first place. They want, they just want some kind of duct tape, kind of slapdash.
I was down at Northeast Utilities, which is in Connecticut. And I'm walking around, and they have lots of internet phones. So that's great. You guys go that way? I said, well, yeah, except senior management. They still have the old ones. Why? Because when the system breaks, and it will, we don't want to lose our jobs because we've put an internet phone on the boss's desk and he can't make his golf day, right? So we put it out there with people that don't have clout, and then it kind of creeps its way back in. Which is how we have always, done this. So big companies can't invent, shouldn't invent. And even when they've made the commitment, and I think I use Xerox as an example, that they're going to do great R&D, then the guys at the front don't listen to them. So you can either spend the right amount of money. To me, what Xerox did was interesting. They were in Rochester, New York. Rochester is so bad that people from Trenton go to Rochester on vacation. I mean, it's and they said, now here they got...
People from Trenton go to Rochester on vacation?
Yeah, right. If Xerox had their head on straight, they would have said, we should have moved corporate headquarters from Rochester to Park.
Yeah, to Palo Alto.
Because this is what was happening. The guy, Jake Goldman, was the R&D director, and he convinced in the 70s Xerox to build the equivalent of Bell Labs. And he said, it's going to take a lot of money. I can't promise anything. We're going to hire the best researchers. We're going to do great work. We're going to take office automation, computers, voice recognition. And they gave him the money. And everyone benefited from this but Xerox.
Yeah.
Xerox moved to Stamford, Connecticut, because they wanted to be closer to Wall Street, which shows you the mindset at a certain point.
That Stanford is really close to Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that they were worried about the stock price and whatever. You can't find a worse run company in the last 25 years.
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know...
But Xerox PARC kind of wound up being like the WPA project for Silicon Valley, right? It was like, let's fund these brilliant researchers to come up with great technology and then go just spawn companies.
Well, the idea was that Xerox was supposed to use that research.
Right.
But all these guys spun out. Today, you couldn't build a Xerox PARC. Because the venture capitalists are going to say, you show me the bright researchers, I'll pay them what Xerox is paying them, and I'll give them some stock.
But I wonder, it's interesting, I mean, what do you think, Kenan Sahin has this company called TIAX, which is sort of like a little mini Xerox PARC out in Cambridge.
Yeah.
I think General Catalyst and someone else invested in BBN Technologies, which is kind of a little Xerox PARC, also in Cambridge. Do you not give those? You don't think those have much throw weight?
What Kenan invested in was a shell of the old Arthur Doolittle, which used to invent products. They actually once made a purse out of a sow's ear.
Yeah, just to show it could
be
done.
I think General Catalyst, and to me, the days of BBN are kind of in decline. I mean, they have been. But the idea is fine. I mean, that's an incubator, and they're going to find some products there. But that's not big company. That's venture capital investing in early stage technology, which has always been the thing we're good at. We're not necessarily good at mezzanine, but we're good at that. And we'll find those guys. What we do as an industry, and remember there's 750 venture capital firms of any size in this country, is we take the best guys out of there and say, why fight the political battle? We'll help start your company, and then we'll sell it back to them, you know, the guys that you left. It's happened again and again. That, in fact, when you look at the Japanese, why is have the Japanese done so badly? Well, the reward structure in Japan gives you great points if you're part of one of the Keiretsus. But they haven't invented shit forever. I mean, Sony was the last innovative company. So that's really our the best part of what we do. But yeah, big companies can't invent. And they try and they spend a lot of money. But when it's all said and done, in fact, I had Desh on one of my panels last year. And he says, you know, when I form one of these companies, there's no obstacles to going after the market because if we don't do that, we fail.
Mm-hmm.
And a larger company, you're doing interesting research, you're getting on the right projects, there's that lack of sense of urgency. And so you only need four things to make something succeed. And you need first-rate brain power, which means that you got to be close to a technical university. God bless the liberal arts graduates, they looked at pictures of naked statues for 4 years, but you need some technology. You need some sophisticated money. You need some templates, other guys that have done it, so you can convince somebody to leave Lincoln Labs or GM or IBM. And then you need a need that's going to grow very quickly, you know, that is just not a little knockoff of a product, but something that's fundamentally better, different. And that's how we build our companies. So big companies rarely do it. And they've tried everything. They've tried... The guys that are doing kind of interesting are Jim Tobin and those guys at Boston Scientific. And what Tobin will tell you is that he's got a list in his pocket of companies that they're interested in. And they'll go in and they'll be a venture capitalist.
Yeah, they make strategic investments.
And what they do is they get, you know, yeah, we'll put in $3 million, we'll own 25% of your company, and if you accomplish these goals, we have the right to buy you back. So what he is doing is acting as a venture capitalist with the idea that while Boston Scientific will do its own R&D, a small focused team will probably outperform them, especially since you don't know exactly where the market's going to move.
Let me just ask you two last things here. One, it sometimes strikes me when you're talking to entrepreneurs that the one quality that really successful entrepreneurs and really terrible delusional entrepreneurs have in common is persistence, right? The terrible ones never know when to give up on a bad idea. The really successful ones never give up and, eventually kind of work their idea, which may have not been perfect in the first place, but they kind of work it into a form where, hey, the market wants it. You can start attracting customers. I mean, do you see that that's true, or are there some other things that you look at that kind of
A great entrepreneur
differentiator
has got to be able to bifurcate his mind.
Uh-huh.
He's got to be persistent. He's got to be a cheerleader. And then sometimes he has to be a real good pragmatist and say, guess what? The sales are not going to reach that number. I need more money. Or guess what? I'm going down a road that's not going to get me there. I got to reverse direction. If you're too strong on either side, you will fail. The best companies have some degree of balance. If they're too strong in technology, that never works. If they're too strong in marketing, all marketing does for a product, good marketing that doesn't work, is let more people know it doesn't work sooner.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everyone says, well, I put together a world-class team. No, shit. Those are not world-class teams that you start. We had a bunch of guys in here the other day. And startup company, interesting kind of area. And the guy says, well, this is my senior vice president, my executive vice president, my senior vice president. I said, what'd you give away all the titles for? He said, what are you talking about? I said, if you're successful in a year or two, you're going to want to bring in better guys.
Yeah, and give them the senior vice president title.
Well, here's what's going to happen. These guys are going to have their nose out of joint. The better people won't work for inferior people. They won't. You know, why don't you just make everybody, quote, a founder, do away with the titles, and then when you have somebody better that'll come on when you want them, this guy's nose is not out of joint. He's got founder stock. He stays on the team. So these are not world, you know, we say they're world-class team, but they're usually three or four of the guys' friends or associates that he starts the company with. Now, we will bring in other people, but you bring them in at the right time. You don't bring them in, all of them, in the beginning. The company's got to do, you know, some development before it can look at, you know, where should we move.
It also seems like companies, whether they're startup companies, medium-sized or large companies, one of the common things that you notice is that they almost never fire people. And I guess I'm just fascinated by that, because if you spend any time working for a company, you kind of know, well, here are the 5 or 10% of people that are always saying no, always saying it can't be done, are not great contributors, maybe don't, you know, aren't startup people, and yet here they are working for a startup. You know, they don't like risk. Why do you think that is, that companies are so reluctant to fire people who are so clearly dead weight?
I've failed that myself. And in fact, one of the things we're learning from Jack Welch is that the importance of that HR person to help you make those decisions.
Jack Welch, I think, used to say, you know, fire the bottom 10% every year or something like that.
And
he actually did it.
And he did it. It's not that he did it. He insisted that his direct reports do it. And he's doing his job. He's, you know, 47 years old. He's got two kids. Doesn't make it. They ought to go. We're not tough enough. And on the boards of directors, we're not tough enough. And it should be kind of the military, up or out. You know, and occasionally you need a professional hard ass to come in and do that. You know, so you're trying to build team spirit. I mean, first of all, a company that's not making money or breaking even is a volatile form of organization. You know, do we change the product? Oh, this customer wants that. Well, does anybody else want it? Oh, they swear that everybody else wants it. Well, we can't figure it. Do we change it? Who do we hire here? We only have so many headcount, and if I get rid of one of these guys, assuming he's not a complete asshole, it hurts morale. How do I keep morale up when things are going bad? Because, you know, 75-85% of these companies are missing their projections. You know, there's a couple of kinds of problems you have. One, your product's late. Two, your product doesn't work. Three, you're making the wrong product. All the products are late. Nobody gets this stuff online. The product doesn't work. Yeah, they work intermittently. Like every third week, they work for 2 minutes. The real problem is you're making the wrong product. And that's awful, because you don't really know. The bells don't go off. It's not selling. The old product is working, or your product is actually a little bit obsolete on what you want. Do you scrap it and whatever? So, yeah, we are more reluctant to get rid of these people. Sometimes they found their stock. What do I do with this? You know, they're, you know, I can't necessarily regenerate that. We would do better if we were tougher here. But you gotta, it's like playing half-court basketball. You show up, and the first five guys are the first team, and the next five guys are the next team. And until you lose, you keep playing. I think that's probably what happens. I made that mistake at Yankee Group. You know, I rarely fired people. You know, I would.
After a while, you start to get the tenured faculty feeling in an organization where people feel like, you know, yeah, I can.
He's doing okay.
Right.
So one of the worst things that can happen for a company, and I saw this happen at Wang, is that their products are doing so well that everyone takes credit for it. And it builds a layer of confidence that's undeserved. The whole sector's going up. We had the only, so everyone looks like they're successful. And then when you hit tough times or adversity, then you see who really is good or not. I'll give you an example. Microsoft has 90,000 employees, or whatever the number is. Microsoft could get rid of 40,000 of those employees tomorrow. They could. They're not really contributing. The organization's bloated, but Ballmer and Gates are part of the establishment, they're part of the Seattle superstructure. They get rid of those people, Seattle, they're not going to do it. You know, so they haven't seen the adversity that comes. And then they kind of looks like, yeah, I do need 27 people in PR and, you know, the organization gets bloated. Not that they're bad people, but you know, the profitability has bloated the organization. Now, show me some adversity, and then you'll see if you got the right guy in there, like IBM. IBM cut $7 billion out of their cost structure. You know, so you need a guy like Jerry York, who is tougher than goddamn nails to do that, because often the founder couldn't do it. Ken Olson couldn't do it. You know, the entrepreneur of the decade, the millennium, or whatever he was. He fired his own brother. Sure, it must be tough, but they would have four groups doing development on the same project, and because they were in a place that had linoleum on the floor, they thought they were, you know, cost conscious. They weren't.
You're known as someone who occasionally says an incendiary thing or two. What's the thing that you say that most aggravates or incites either your business school students or when you think back to the Yankee Group days that most aggravated a CEO? I mean, what would be kind of among your greatest hits of
you know, I always thought
grenade
that
throwing.
The truth can be a very aggravating thing if it comes at you. And I always felt, might as well tell the truth. I'm not smart enough to remember the lies. You know, but sometimes when you say your industry is showing saturation and it's going to stop growing this quickly, that was something no one ever wanted to hear.
So give me an example of that. I mean,
I was down at EDS and I was telling these guys that I saw the ends of you know, what was happening in outsourcing, and that only companies that were failing were hiring EDS. They wouldn't want to go to EDS the other way. Well, these guys went, you know, ballistic on me. The joy of when I ran Yankee Group is there was no client that was over 1% of my business. So I don't care who I pissed off. I mean, I would try and piss people off. I wouldn't just say, here's the problem that you have and you're not going to get there going the way you want. Business school, you know, what I say is that half these guys are going to work for the wrong companies at the wrong time. They're one phase behind. That the world doesn't need 25 people on the deal team at Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
That what looks safe is really risky. And what looks risky is really safe.
So you're saying all your B-school students, imagine they want to go work on Wall Street at an investment bank or a venture capital firm or something that they perceive will make them a lot of money.
Or work for hedge funds. You know, we got, what, 8,500 hedge funds now? Yeah, and also it's a bad use of talent. Look at all the talent that we have. It's just wasted there. The real reason that you ought to start your own company, if you can, is you'll never use all your talents as well working for somebody else. I mean, every strength, every weakness you have when you start a company, you use. My first job out of school, I worked for a little company in East Cambridge called Shintron. And I'd been there, you know, and I went to work at 22 years old after my MBA. And they thought I was doing a good job and gave me a raise. And I knew I was only getting 25% out of myself. You know, I went home, you know, at the end of the day. So when I started my company, and Yankee Group started my second bedroom, used all your talents. And if you're going to work, why not use all your talents? So that's probably, you know, one of the issues. But I never really tried to say incendiary things. It just sounded that way at the time. But, you know, I mean, I used to go down to IBM, for example, and I said, IBM used to have this thing called SRI, Systems Research Lab. And I would say, these are the, you know, early days of, you know, even mini computers. I said, what happens if computing's free and software's free? Now where do you guys go? Well, get this communist out of here. But when you start to look at what processing power was, it was free, and communications was free. Free is awful hard to compete with. So you start to say, oh, that's, you know, where do I want to be on the power curve? You know, where do I want to put my money? Right now, you know, the advice industry, if you would, is going through a horrible period. You know, essentially non-growth, IDG, Gartner, Yankee, Forrester, they're doing consolidation. You know, Gartner bought Meta the other day. You know, it's getting a pretty predictable kind of industry. It's time to move on.
Before I left, Howard suggested we talk a little bit about some of the technology trends that are overhyped and some areas where he feels there's still opportunity.
Be careful when you find yourself agreeing with too many people. Nanotech looks to me to be a $0 billion business for the next few years. I am enormously skeptical about RFID.
Someone referred to it recently as WMID.
Yeah.
Walmart ID, you know, that there's one customer for it, and they're just...
You know what? Walmart, think of, you know, usually when you negotiate with Walmart, there's a lot of blood on the floor, and it's mostly yours.
Yeah.
So Walmart...
Why do you want to sell technology to that company?
Yeah, also, what Walmart wants is as many suppliers as possible, each betting that if they only had a little more volume, they would make money. I was talking to Tom Stenberg a few months ago, and I said, well, how are you guys going to use it? He says, well... Maybe we're not big enough because we can't find a real application. He said, Staples, $3 billion company. I said, you know, you could put the chip on. He said, do you think I'm going to have one of my managers in a store chasing some guy down the street because they've taken an 89-cent tablet because it's got an RFID? He says, that doesn't make any sense at all. So, you know, it's cute. We'll play with it. Gillette's playing with it. You know, Walmart's pushing. But I've seen General Motors try the same thing with the manufacturing automation protocol. They didn't even use it themselves. But everyone built it in at a much greater cost. So I look at RFID as a sinkhole for venture capital money. There's 43 venture capital-based RFID companies, last time I counted. Maybe three or four of them make it, and maybe 31 of them or 41 of them don't. So now, there are areas of material science that I find interesting. I'm pleased with the progress we've made at A123.
Which is a battery company, yes.
It's a battery company. I mean, I brought Motorola in as an investor and as a customer, and they just signed a deal with Black & Decker, and we're now working with Gillette. So those are the sorts of things that I think someone's going to turn around. Warren Buffett is going to say at a Gillette board meeting, where's our new technology from Duracell coming from? And then they're going to go buy some of these companies that are going to get bigger. But when I look at eGenera, I'm glad I invested in these guys in the year 2000. Would I invest in one more blade server company like this in 2005? I think the game's over. It's too late.
What does look promising? I mean, if you were raising another fund, if you were out there actively investing.
If I could understand the biotech stuff better, it would be an area that I would be intrigued in. If I had a 25-year-old kid, which I do, where would I aim him, which I have? And he's working for Pequot Venture Capital, looking at healthcare stuff. Interesting area. I only wanted to work in areas where I had an unfair advantage. If I have no unfair advantage, I shouldn't be in it.
unfair advantage in terms of knowledge of how the technology works, the markets work.
Yankee Group, I knew what was going to happen, you know, as earlier than any of those guys. And I kind of could make it happen, and I could see who the winners were going to be. And I knew the companies, and I knew the market. You know, that, I mean, that's why Battery Ventures succeeded. I mean, Battery Ventures never stepped out of the area that was its own core competence. Battery Ventures never did any of these things. And it succeeded, you know. If I'm just one more, you know, punk and pinstripes with more money, I shouldn't play in that game, because if I win, I may actually think I know what I'm talking about when I don't.